Chapter the Seventh. Oh, the Viscountess herself. Oh, my. I felt an almost insurmountable urge to flee, as if somehow she knew, which of course she couldn't possibly, but what if she recognized me? And what if she then realized that I was not from the Woman's Gazette at all, but poking my rather pronounced nose into her affairs? What if she suspected I was in receipt of a peculiar pink fan? All these frightened thoughts cried out in my mind even before I turned to follow the butler upstairs. At times such as these, it is a very good thing that my father had been a logician, and I had educated myself with his books, as follows. Premise. Viscountess Inglethorpe and I occupied the parlour of the ladies' lavatory at the same time. Premise. She will recognize me. Conclusion. Inconclusive. Weak premise. She noticed me and recognizes me. Premise. She will realize I am not a reporter from the Women's Gazette. Conclusion. Not valid, as such a reporter might very well use the ladies' lavatory. However, just as these calming, rational thoughts began to take hold, also just as I achieved the top of the stairway, there was a bang as the heavy front door whammed open and a man's voice roared, "Ha, ha!" I jumped and squeaked like a snared rabbit, for it was the voice of the exceedingly inhospitable man with the mastiff and the sunk fence. But it couldn't be. My logical mind attempted once more to intercede. What possible reason?
Ha, ha, here we are.
The butler, who in the expressionless way of butlers seemed as startled as I, said,
"Excuse me just a moment, miss,"
and went downstairs again to see what was what, leaving me peering over the railing.
"File on in, ha, ha. Gawk all you please, ragamuffins."
Oh, my evil stars! I could see now. It was the same burly man who had threatened to leave me rotting in his midnight ditch. Progressing into the entry hall, resplendent in ascot, paddock jacket, charcoal breeches and cream-coloured gaiters, with his pugnacious face straining to maintain a smirk that was probably intended to be a smile, he was followed by a most unlikely company. Orphans filing in two by two. Little girls in the traditionally hideous brown gingham pinafores, with their hair cropped so short for the prevention of lice that they scarcely looked female despite their ruffled caps. The butler approached the ha-ha man and bowed gravely, murmuring something.
"Just giving the little beggars a treat, ha-ha," the man roared.
From my refuge behind the stair railings, I watched in fascination as his balding forehead turned tomato red.
"Anything wrong with that?"
The butler's deferential manner had apparently concealed some question of the man's presence under the circumstances.
"Look, but don't touch,"
admonished a starchy, middle-aged female at the end of the brown gingham line, a matron of the orphanage, I knew the instant I saw her, not merely because of her plain brown dress and her even more severe demeanour, but because she wore, like all such matrons, the most outlandish and unmistakable hat, white cotton starched into the shape of an inverted tulip with ruffles around its edge. The minute I had a chance, I must draw a picture of an orphanage matron like a plain brown tower with a bulbous white beacon on top.
"Shall I notify the Viscountess?"
the butler was asking. Or not asking, really. Warning.
"No need. Just showing the darlings what they have to look forward to. Ha, ha. If they go into service in my house, you know. Ha, ha."
With which outrageous statement, for quite plainly from the butler's manner this was not his house, the smirking and glowering mastiff-like man bellowed,
"This way, urchins!"
and strode onward. Huddled shoulder to shoulder, clutching each other's hands, with their faces displaying the terror I felt, the orphans followed more slowly. From behind, the matron herded them as they all disappeared from my view beneath the stairway from which I watched. Even though I knew that the ha-ha man had not seen me and would not have recognized me in any event, even so my heart thumped, and while ladies never sweat, or even perspire, certainly I felt my personage pass into the condition known as all in a glow. The butler returned upstairs, his white face so eloquently blank that I dared not ask him who the ha-ha man was. Indeed, I dared not speak. With difficulty I made myself let go of the stair railing to which I had been clinging. In icy silence the butler showed me to the door.
Miss, the journalistic personage of whom I informed you, my lady,
he announced me as he opened it. He intended, it seemed, to allow his mistress to remain ignorant of the invasion downstairs, at least for the moment, and in my dubious presence.
Yes, quite.
As the Viscountess brusquely gestured for me to enter, she scarcely looked at me, thank goodness. After a moment I was able to take a deep breath and regain some measure of calm. Her ladyship did not, of course, invite me to be seated. A common news reporter would not be staying long. Nor did she give me a chance to ask her any questions. She quite took charge.
I want you to see what I wore for the pink tea.
On cue, a maid-in-waiting emerged from a walk-in closet, carrying a fabric confection of pink.
That is a Worth gown,
the Viscountess declared as she began to read aloud from a salon programme.
This exquisite tea gown is fashioned from pink sheen pompadour taffeta with graceful godette pleating, trimmed around the...
Write it down! I want you to get it all just as I say! Obediently I scribbled, meanwhile aware that the jade damask-at-home day dress the Viscountess wore might be described every bit as elaborately. Indeed, it seemed to me one might almost be presented to the Queen in it. It could not have been more apparent to me that this woman had aspirations above her station.
Trimmed around the neckline with puffed white tulle over scallops of pearl-studded sateen, while a double strand of rare pink pearls begins at the bust and drapes to one side of the skirt, fastened there with a clasp of pink gold inspired by Michelangelo's Sibyls of the Sistine Chapel. Have you got all that?
Yes, my lady, I lied. And might I inquire the names of those who attended, my lady? Now that I knew who the Viscountess was, I wanted to find out who had been the other dragonish dowager accompanying her, with Lady Cecily, on the occasion when I had first encountered them. I hoped the other ogress's identity might be disclosed by the pink tea guest list.
Oh, yes, I have the list here. There was the Countess of Woodcroft, of course.
She said this in such a by-the-by manner that I knew the Countess was her prize catch for the event.
Lady Diana Woodcroft. Count Thaddeus was unfortunately unable to attend. And then there were the three daughters of the Earl of Throstlebine, the Honourable Mrs. Ermengarde, Ermyntrude, and Ermyneine Crowe, escorted by...
This went on and on until I began to despair of ever sorting it out.
And the Baroness Maganza, Lady Aquila Maganza. She is my sister, you know.
Oh, really? My interest was not feigned. Did this sister by any chance look almost exactly like her? Was Lady Aquila Maganza the one...
Indeed. Aquila married rather beneath her station, I fear.
Pompous nonsense, for practically speaking, a baron is no better or worse a creature than a viscount.
Her husband did not attend, but she brought along her son, Bramwell, and his fiancée, the Honourable Cecily Alistair.
Yes, oh yes! As one ogress was the Viscountess, so most certainly the other ogress had to be her sister Aquila, who had a son named Bramwell, who intended to marry the unfortunate Lady Cecily. Finding it very difficult to hide my excitement as I scrawled the names, I babbled... A very attractive young lady, I am sure.
She could be, if she would trouble herself. Quite spoilt and rather a child, I fear.
But then, abruptly, as if my interest in Lady Cecily caused her to close a door on further discourse, Lady Otilia turned her back. Her derriere, I noticed, showed the effect of too much horseback riding on a side saddle, being visibly asymmetrical, the right part higher than the left. With difficulty I suppressed a smile. The Viscountess gestured dismissal.
That is all.
Yes, my lady. One must play one's part. I actually bobbed a sort of curtsy. Thank you, my lady. The butler waited to show me out, his demeanour now so upright as to be nearly martial. I wondered whether the apparently uninvited parade of orphans had yet left the premises, but I did not dare mention them, for I had a request to make. Once safely down the stairs, I asked whether I might speak with the housekeeper, Dawson, again, just for a moment, to thank her for her helpfulness, I toadied. With lofty indifference, the butler assented. A few moments later, the friendly Dawson sat down in the servants' lounge with me. She was pleased to go over the Pink Tea's guest list with me in much greater detail than her mistress had done. I will spare the gentle reader any account of the gossip that necessarily preceded what I wanted to know. I encouraged several minutes of confidences before I felt it safe to display curiosity regarding Viscountess Ottilia and her sister, Lady Aquila. "Oh, yes," declared the good Dawson. "As like as two peas in a pod, they are." "Eureka," I thought. Just as I had surmised, it must have been Baroness Aquila I had seen with Viscountess Ottilia and Lady Cecily in the ladies' lavatory. My poor left-handed lady. I suppressed an urge to shudder for her. As Bramwell Merganza, the groom-to-be, was Aquila's son, then unless I could thwart her scheme, that charming woman would become poor Cecily's mother-in-law. Although yearning to know more of the proposed wedding, I needed to proceed carefully with Dawson so as not to arouse suspicion. Even the most garrulous servant retains loyalty to her mistress. I made myself sit back in my chair across the tea-table from her. "Have they many children?" I asked, as this was the question that would most naturally arise next concerning the sisters Ottilia and Aquila. The propagation of numerous children, although a nuisance among the lower classes, was considered quite a virtue among the gentry, exemplified by Queen Victoria herself, who had produced 9. "Sadly, my lady, the Viscountess, has no living progeny," said Dawson with sympathy, yet at the same time a certain relish that the tragedy of child mortality due to spotted fever and the like was not confined to the lower classes. "And of Baroness Aquila's 5, only Bramwell has survived to adulthood. She has made rather a mama's boy of him, I fear," added Dawson pensively as she refilled our teacups. Outwardly, I hope, I remained bland, but inwardly I bayed and panted, a hound hot on the scent. "Indeed, how old is he?" "Nearly 30, and still living at home, doing nothing on his own. And he appears to be likely to spend the rest of his life that way, for all that he's soon to be married." "Yes, so I see." Very natural, my curiosity, very innocent. "This Lady Cecily Alistair, who is she?" "A cousin. Her father, Eustace Alistair, is Lady Aquila's brother, and Lady Ottilia's, of course." Oh, dear, how odious. Yet there was nothing scandalous in the arrangement, for cousins marrying cousins is a common practice among blue-bloods to keep property in the family. With the unintentional effect, according to Malthus, that each generation grows uglier than the last, and marrying his daughter to his sister's son was exactly the sort of thing Sir Eustace would do. I remembered how his concern had been all for hushing up scandal rather than for his daughter's safety when Cecily had been kidnapped. After her return, I felt sure, he had regarded her not as a victim, but as a disgrace. He had no concern for her sensibilities. In order to avoid any further embarrassment to himself, therefore, he had arranged to marry her off privately rather than have her presented at court. I wondered how much dowry he had paid to the Merganzas. Dawson awaited my response. "A good match," I ventured. "Yes, indeed, a very good match it is." All this time I had put off a fascinating but indelicate question. I quite wanted to know who the ha-ha man was, a gentleman by his dress, perhaps even titled with some connection to this household. Therefore, even though I knew otherwise, I asked, "Was it Sir Eustace, by any chance, who so kindly escorted the orphans?" But I had reached the limits of Dawson's willingness to divulge. She responded only with gentle distress. "No, indeed, that was not Sir Eustace. And as for his bringing those dreadfully common children into this house unannounced, But it's not my place to say more. You'll excuse me, I'm sure.